Give this lecture on what I call the nature of naturalness. I'll just move this. So, as I understand from the conference, there are all sorts of theoretical physicists here, not just particle theory or string theory. And so I think it's sort of useful to give a little bit of a background on how particle physicists see the universe. So the way I pictured it here, the universe is a series of effective field theories. Effective field theory, which I'm going to tell you a lot more about as I go on in the 30 minutes, theories which relate the length scale to energy scale, namely that as we go to shorter distances, then the energy increases. And for each iteration, as we go on, we seem to have more and more effective field theories at each stage of the development. They have similar forms, sort of just like this Russian doll picture, but nevertheless, they have distinct features as you go from energy scale to energy scale. The key thing that distinguishes any given theory is the domain of applicability within the energy that one has. Okay. So what do I mean by this? So effective field theory is characterized by all of the particles or fields, the couplings and symmetries involved in the particular theory at hand. So what one does is writes down an action for this theory, which has some series of fields, scalars, fermions, gauge field strength, or even, for example, gravity, like the Ricci scalar, all embedded into some action principle of which you integrate over, minimize, and from that extract the physics. The way this is done, though, and the reason this is called an effective field theory, is that you write all combinations of fields consistent with the symmetries with coefficients that have a single dimensionful scale, call it lambda, where this soaks up whatever dimension any given operator has or doesn't have. Okay. And I'll show what I mean by that now. So this is one that many of you will be familiar with. If I just do quantum electrodynamics, then what we have is a theory with a series of terms which I can organize by their mass dimension, starting with, for example, the lowest dimension term in QED, the electron, which couples the left and right chiralities left-handed electron. Kinetic terms for the electron and the kinetic term for QED, for the photon, and then some series of higher dimensional operators suppressed by the scale, lambda. So the domain of applicability of the theory, the width of this Russian doll, is in fact exactly this range between the electron mass up to the cutoff scale of the theory, lambda, which I've written here. This is the dimension, the other dimensionful scale in the problem. And you could say, well, okay, that's fine, wonderful. What is this scale? Well, in QED, it's really just the muon mass, because once we go beyond that, then things change. We renormalize and have other particles running in loops and such things. So obviously, we have to change the effective theory and add in an additional particle. Now, this is, at first, you'd stare at what I wrote and said there's a puzzle, because I wrote two mass scales, not just one. I didn't write everything in terms of just lambda, one scale in the problem, but lambda and the electron mass. And so you might say, well, this is a problem, because how is it that I have two scales? A natural effective theory would be one which had everything in terms of just a single scale lambda. But of course, the electron mass is about 1/200th the size of the muon mass, so this is the range of applicability of QED. So in this range, we see that there is one parameter that appears to be small relative to the cutoff scale of the theory, namely it's 10^-2. Okay, so it's 1/100th what it should be. Now you might say, okay, well that's fine, but why do I care? Well, you care because quantum corrections could potentially change the size of any given parameter in the theory. The worry, of course, is that quantum corrections to the electron mass would lead to something where you have some bare term, and then you get a linear correction associated with the cutoff scale. If this were true, it would mean you would draw all of the mass scales up to the single cutoff scale of the theory, the single scale lambda. Okay. Now, fortunately, this, as probably most of you know, doesn't happen in QED. QED is safe. It's safe in the sense that the electron mass does not receive linear quantum corrections to its mass. Okay? Linear meaning additive quantum corrections. Instead, what you actually find is that if you, you know, just go ahead and calculate something, here's the bare term and here is a quantum correction with a photon running in the loop, and here's the chirality flip that's ever crucial for understanding this, then you can see that the electron mass is actually multiplicatively renormalized, which means that as you add quantum corrections to the theory, then the electron shifts by some amount, but it's an amount proportional to the electron mass to begin with. Okay. And when you generalize this to the standard model, the same thing happens for Yukawa couplings. Okay, so the idea being then that the cutoff scale dependence of this theory is buried within something that multiplies the electron mass. And that's how quantum corrections enter for the electron. In the limit that the electron mass goes to zero, then, well, this equation is trivial. It just vanishes, and there is no renormalization of the electron. So quantum corrections do not lead to an electron mass if there isn't one already. This is significant, and this actually has a much deeper significance that goes back to Tuft, who realized in 1979 that, in fact, this limit in which the electron mass goes to zero, okay, leads to something where you have a fixed point in the normalization group, is actually due to a very important principle, namely one in which you get an enhanced symmetry of the low energy effective theory that you have. And in the case of the electron, it's very easy. It's originally, an electron has a left and a right-handed component. You marry them off with a mass term. This explicitly breaks the chiral symmetries down to a diagonal. So in the limit that I take the electron mass to zero, then I'm free to rotate the left or right-handed electron as I see fit. So I enhance, in this case, the chiral symmetries of the theory. Okay. Parameters in which you take them to zero and you end up with an enhanced symmetry are known as technically natural. And it's this sense that I want to talk about naturalness in the theory for the rest of the talk. So with that sort of brief introduction, if you now generalize this from just QED to the standard model and look at all of the particles and interactions that one has, you find that, well, here's some fancy picture that comes from Fermilab, quarks, gauge bosons, okay, everything that exists in the effective theory that we have tested up to now. This is as far as we can go in terms of energy scale, all of these particles. This theory is one which has a series of parameters, a whole bunch of them, and so we can count them up. Before neutrino masses, there was 19, and now there's many more, and I don't even know the count. Okay, but the point is that virtually all of the parameters in this theory are also technically natural, meaning that they receive renormalization through multiplicative renormalization, or in the sense that I take the coupling to zero and I enhance the symmetry. Okay? And this is certainly true for the fermion masses, or more generally, the Yukawa couplings, gauge couplings, CKM elements, MNS elements for the neutrinos, everything. Okay. What this means is that if these parameters are technically natural, then it means that renormalization is not drawing them up to the cutoff scale, and so I can actually have a range of energy by which I can understand this theory. And that's the sense in which we can understand the range of applicability of the standard model as we have it now. But I wouldn't be here if there wasn't a few offenders. there are a handful of parameters which are nevertheless technically unnatural, which means to say that they don't receive multiplicative renormalization, but they actually receive quantum corrections linear to this cutoff scale. Naively, they would then be drawn up to whatever the cutoff scale is, or the mass parameters. There's three famous ones: the Higgs mass squared, the cosmological constant, which I'll write is just lambda cc, and the QCD vacuum angle, which I won't have much to say about in this. Okay. So let me first talk about the Higgs mass squared parameter. So this is something that, if you've seen talks before on the standard model, you'll recognize this fairly quickly. The notion of what is it that breaks electroweak symmetry in the standard model, this is just a Higgs field, a scalar field, a complex doublet, which acquires an expectation value by writing down some particular potential. Here it is. Okay. This potential has a minimum away from the origin because the mass squared itself is actually negative. And in fact, the symmetry breaking scale itself is determined effectively by this mass squared, whatever the mass squared of the Higgs is. The problem is that the mass squared of the Higgs receives quantum corrections, which you can write down, for example, diagrammatically like this. Here they are at one loop. Okay, so there's something with W and Z loop running around in a loop, the Higgs itself through its self-coupling, and also diagrams that would couple to the fermions. And all of these diagrams actually you depend linearly on the cutoff scale squared of the theory, so that the quantum corrected Higgs mass, which is this bare term here, which I write as mh squared there, plus these contributions, which depend on the particular gauge bosons running a loop, hence the gauge coupling squared coefficients that I've got here, and the lambda top with the Yukawa coupling, times lambda squared over 16 pi squared, where lambda is now the cutoff. So naively, the Higgs mass squared gets drawn up to this scale lambda, and you cannot separate scales to maintain a Higgs mass squared. You might say, but this is nuts, okay? Because surely what one does is simply sets the cutoff appropriate so that you don't get a correction like this. So we've only tested the standard model up to a few hundred GeV, so why isn't the cutoff just set at a few hundred GeV and be done with it? Problem is that that's not easy to do, at least from the perspective of the standard model, as an effective theory, because as I said from the very beginning, an effective theory is one in which I write down all of the operators consistent with the symmetries, of which the mass dimension is soaked up by this parameter lambda cutoff scale. So, for example, quantum gravity seems to sit way up at M Planck. This is a scale very high in the theory that one would like to imagine could be there. But in addition, there are even just processes within the standard model itself that are potentially dangerous if the cutoff scale were set to be too low a value. These include, for example, the fact that there are operators that lead to proton decay. Here's one of them, so QQQL, okay, it's a dimension 6 operator suppressed by 1 over lambda squared. In a natural theory, this has an order 1 coefficient, and so when I take this lambda off to or a high enough value so that the proton lives 10 to the 33 years or so, consistent with observations, you find that lambda's got to be 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay, so this is the tension, right? That the Higgs mass squared is very small, 100 GeV or so. Yet there are operators in the theory that if we introduce those with the same scale, would lead to observable consequences that are entirely ruled out by experiment. Moreover, if you think about, so not only is the non-observation of certain processes important, but even the observation of things that we've seen, especially in the last few years. For example, if neutrino mass comes from just a higher dimensional operator, namely if it's a Majorana mass, then it just comes from this operator here, which is dimension 5, suppressed by the cutoff scale lambda. And when you plug in the electroweak scale squared and divide by some lambda, and you get the neutrino mass that has been observed in all various experiments in this country and in many others, you find that lambda has to be larger than something like 10 to the 13 GeV. Okay, so both the observation of some, the apparent observation of some operators, as well as the non-observation of other operators, suggests that this cutoff scale has to be very large. That means that then when you plug this in and compute the rated correction to the Higgs mass square, well, here's what it looks like. So I start with some bare term. Here's one with all the zeros, and I think I got the right number. Okay, you can count and check me. And then here's the quantum correction. These two numbers have to add up where over here there's this digit is different, and when you add these up, you have to get 100 GeV squared. And that's our understanding of the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking to date. So this is obviously unsatisfactory because this requires tuning these two parameters, a quantum correction against a bare mass to 1 part in 10 to the 30. Now, fortunately, there has been a lot of theoretical work on this to look at mechanisms that try to resolve this particular problem. And let me just sort of throw out a few of the names of the ideas that do this. I'm not going to talk about them in detail here, obviously. There are ideas where you add new symmetries to the theory that try to take this Higgs mass parameter from a technically unnatural state and make it natural again. For example, if you could extend the chiral symmetries of fermions to scalars, then indeed this would be a way to go, and this is what supersymmetry does. You can imagine trying to enlarge the global symmetries of the theory, in which this would also protect the Higgs mass. This goes under the name of little Higgs theories. There are ways in which you can imagine that the mass squared of a Higgs comes about dynamically, very much like the pion mass or the baryon mass of QCD. These come from just dynamics of SU3 color getting strong at a low scale, dimensional transmutation. And if you imagine doing this, you can imagine, these go under the names of technicolor is one of the theories, or the idea that the Higgs itself is composite, and these are correlated ideas. And finally, there are ways to try to understand that maybe the cutoff scale is not supposed to be actually at 10 to the 18 or 10 to the 16 GeV, and these sort of go under the name of extra-dimensional theories. Okay. All of these cases, this is what these ideas are trying to resolve about this problem. Good. So we have all of these ideas, which have been with us, some of them, for many, many years. Fortunately, there is ongoing and, in particular, future experiments that will test these ideas very quickly from the perspective of at least electroweak symmetry breaking. This is one of them, the Large Hadron Collider in France and Switzerland. This machine will collide protons on protons at 14 TeV. It's now under construction, should be complete in about a year or so. That's when first collisions will happen, and then there should be data taking within just a year or a couple of years after that. This is an incredibly exciting time, actually, to be a particle physicist, because this thing will finally either find or rule out these ideas that we've had for a long time. Okay. So one of the reasons I actually am not going to talk about all these things in detail is, you know, now it's time for experiment to go and look and see what they're going to find. Okay. So that's what happens with one of the parameters of the standard model. Here's the second one. Okay, I had three of them, and I'm going to talk only about two of them, the CC, okay, the cosmological constant. This, too, is a parameter that is technically unnatural. And, in fact, it has a long history, which I can't resist trying to wake you up, so I'll do what I can here. The history goes back to, of course, this guy, right, Big Al, in which he introduced a cosmological constant to keep the universe static, and then removed it after Hubble discovered that the universe was actually expanding. I like to think that this must have been paraphrased by this certain senator from Massachusetts, in which he said, well, I actually voted for it before I voted against it. So the energy budget of the universe these days is a very curious affair, and you'll see the connection to the CC in a moment. from experiments that include WMAP and a whole series of other experiments on the CMB, as well as observations of supernova, type 1a supernova, that appear to be accelerating, the universe accelerating in its expansion. Many of these pieces of data, and including large-scale structure observations, come to the conclusion that here's the energy budget of the universe. It is, in fact, now known to be made mostly of unknowns. Okay. Namely, about 3/4 of it being this stuff called dark energy, about 1/4 dark matter, and this little wee sliver left over for us. Okay. This is the status. This is an embarrassment. Right? The bulk of the energy density of the universe is stuff we don't know anything about. Now, you know, dark matter, there are at least ideas, and you can imagine particle physics to solve this problem. But dark energy is a big mystery, and you'll see shortly that it's certainly connected to the CC. Dark energy is given its name because one wants to generalize the kind of stuff that could lead to an acceleration. Okay? Cosmological constant is one example of that. But actually, when you go and look at the data, and here's right from WMAP 2006, if you look at the data and where it tends to prefer this particular parameter W, which is just a parameter that characterizes the equation of state of this dark energy, you find that it is roughly -1, which corresponds to a pure cosmological constant. So right now, it looks like that the best way, or the best interpretation of this dark energy, is in fact just a cosmological constant. Okay, that's fine, so what's the problem? Well, the problem is that when you measure this thing, okay, and here's the number, it's something of order 10⁻³ eV, all quantity to the 4th power. This is a really, really small number. This is certainly far, this is far smaller than the electron mass or the electroweak scale, any other things. And naively, because this parameter itself is technically unnatural, because it will receive quantum corrections that potentially can lift it up to potentially all the way up to the Planck scale, this appears to require then a fine-tuning between these bare and quantum-corrected cosmological constants on the order of 1 part in 10⁻². So the stuff of the universe, the dominant stuff that is gravitating in the universe, appears to be that which we have the least control over quantum mechanically. At some sense, the problem is even worse than you might think. And let me just flash these two things quickly. If you look even more in detail at data and you say, well, okay, first of all, what is the total energy density of the universe as a function of critical? You find that it's 1 to within a few percent. If you look at the spectrum of density perturbations in the early universe, spectral index is 1, or actually now about 0.95 or so. I may not have the last digit exactly right. But to some error here that leads us to believe n is actually a little bit different from 1 and even a little bit negative. These two pieces of information are two things that strongly suggest the early universe experienced an epoch of inflation. Okay? This is if you go back to, for example, if you go back to Kolben-Turner and you look up the chapter on inflation written in 1990, and you say, what are the tests of inflation at a time when neither of these two things were at all clear? What he found was, or what Kolben-Turner wrote was, the three tests of inflation would be 1, omega should be 1, 2, n should be 1 up to a few percent or so, and the third thing was gravity waves observed in the polarization of CMB. So we've got 2 of 3, and the last one, of course, may well come in the next few years from the Planck Explorer. Okay. All right, so this data suggests that there is this epoch of inflation. And how this comes about is because there was, presumably then, a large vacuum energy at a certain time in the universe that was gravitating, that caused the accelerated expansion to begin with, be it from a scalar field or otherwise. Okay, so some large cosmological constant seemed to have to actually be, quote unquote, gravitating, if you like. But then even at later stages in the universe, when you go through phase transitions, you shift the zero-point energy of the vacuum, for example, from the electroweak phase transition or the QCD phase transition, so that if you try to draw a plot, and this is a cartoon, not a real plot, you know, if you tried to draw a cartoon of what the time-dependent history of the CC might be, it might look something like this, where you initially have some large value that is the epoch of inflation. There is then some other sort of other lower level values such that after you cross the electroweak phase transition and the QCD phase transition, these pieces are canceled very precisely against the energy that got dumped into the vacuum, quote unquote. Okay. So it's not enough to simply say the CC is small and it's just small for some symmetry reason, like supersymmetry or something like that, because we actually want this thing to gravitate. The best way of sort of phrasing this, I think, is that despite our best efforts, there's really no compelling ideas to try to explain this. And in some sense, it's even worse because it appears to be a time-dependent problem. It's not even something that you can just solve for once and get it over with. This is worrisome because it has led to the possibility that we need to generalize what we mean by natural parameters in effective field theories. And in particular, we might have to generalize it with this, the A word, anthropic. I bring this up because, in fact, I think the only rationale that we have for a small cosmological constant appears to be the idea that we exist. Namely, having a large scale structure that forms from density perturbations that were able to grow during an epoch of matter domination and go nonlinear. You can put a bound on the size of the CC, which is on the order of about 100 times the critical density. Okay? This was a bound that Weinberg derived many, many years ago, 1987, so nearly 20 years ago. If you actually assume that the probability distribution for this thing is flat, you find that you would actually expect the CC to be of order, the cutout, the bound that you get from and this quote-unquote anthropic reasoning, and in fact it is. Okay? So at some level, this was a prediction of the CC, and it came true. Of course, this is a prediction in a funny sense of the word prediction. Is this something that is natural? Is it scientific? It's not clear. For example, do we think that our existence on Earth is somehow important? The fact that we happen to live a certain distance from the sun such that we have liquid water and blah, 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 you know, all the usual arguments that people give. Well, presumably there's a huge ensemble of planets with a whole bunch of different orbits, and we just happen to sit on the one that, you know, is at the right distance to give liquid water. Perhaps the same thing is true for the CC. We just happen to live in the one vacuum that after all of these phase transitions go through, we're left with virtually no vacuum energy in the universe. It's possible, string theory might even suggest that this is should be likely if you think about what's called the landscape of vacua that they have. I'm not a string theorist, so I'm not going to evaluate that. But I think once you begin to think about the CC being, quote-unquote, anthropically natural, you might worry about other parameters and go back to the Higgs mass squared or other parameters and begin to wonder, are they natural or unnatural? Should we have other anthropic reasoning for why certain technically unnatural parameters would be small? And for some time, people thought that this could be done for the electroweak scale. And let me just make a, this is sort of a plug for a recent work, but a series of us, postdoc at Slack and a postdoc at Berkeley, Ronnie Harnack and Gilad Perez and I, we actually looked at this possibility of what happens with the electroweak scale if indeed you push it off to some very high value and you see what sort of universe you get out. And it turns out that actually for a general effective theory, you show that you can actually completely decouple electroweak interactions and still end up with a quote unquote interesting universe, okay? This is one that has BDN and stars that live for billions of years that still burn, not through PP, but now through other interactions. And not only can you show this, but you can show that this works because you can match this crazy universe without weak interactions onto ours. And by matching it on, it means, well, if it works in ours, it works in this one. And you can do this continually for sort of all of these effects. So this at least seems to be a counterexample to anthropic selection of the electroweak scale, which makes me happy. Okay. So you could, if you like, put this on a scorecard. I didn't talk about theta QCD, but for those who might be wondering what connection this has, it's generally thought to not be determined by anthropics. And we do have mechanisms to understand why it's small. For example, adding a U1 symmetry, the axion. The Higgs mass squared was for some time, I think, thought to be anthropic, but I think it's fairly clear, at least from this work and others like it, that this is no longer true, and we have mechanisms to stabilize this. Okay, supersymmetry, all these other ideas that I presented earlier. The CC still appears to be one that might need anthropics to actually resolve why it's so small, and we still don't really have a compelling reason for why it is small from effective field theory itself. Okay, so this is where we're at. I think then, to sort of wrap it up, what one would say is that the cosmological constant problem at least appears to be qualitatively different from all of the other technically unnatural parameters in the standard model. Certainly it's different from electro weak scale, as we showed, and I go off and read the paper. It's a fun paper to actually read, actually. So I think one ends up to a point where asking, is nature really natural in the sense of effective field theory? And this is something that is still an ongoing area of research that we're trying to understand. That's it. Thanks.